Mark chapter 4, verse 35 is where I'll be. I'll have the scriptures on the board if you need that. I'm going to do it a little bit different today. On that day when evening had come, Jesus said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" I would imagine you're like me. You have read this passage many times. But it wasn't until recently that I was reading this that it jumped out at me that he questioned their fear and their faith together. And he put those two together. Their fear was real. And he indicated that because of their fear, they had a faith problem. And I had never put the two together before, that if you have fear, you have a faith problem. And it really got my attention. Fear is real. From verse 40 and 41, look at what he said. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And this was a terrible storm, and he was sleeping right through it. And they woke him up, and this is what he said to them. And then verse 41, and they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this?" And that's when he questioned their faith. And I'm sure that you're like those disciples before. You have questioned your faith. And you've been afraid before. And I know that I have. I know fear is real. I remember on various lakes and things like that, being afraid at times. And you know, we go out sometimes in little bitty boats and we got caught and things like that. And I remember one time when I was quite young, I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, and we had went to Lake Washita, and I had convinced the older guys to let me go run the lines, fishing lines, with them late at night. And we had started down the bank, and they had woke me up from a dead sleep, and I thought, man, maybe it wouldn't be such a bad idea to stay back with the ladies, the little kids, you know, but I thought I was a big guy then. We started down the bank. It was the middle of the night, and it was dark. It was warm during the day, but it was cold at night. There was a fog and mist, and we started down toward the boats, and I was in front, had my flashlight, and I got to a point, I saw eyes looking back at me. And I'll tell you, I was afraid. And I said, "Hold it. There's something looking at us." And it was my dad and my grandfather and another man. These were all Christian men that I trusted. I trusted these guys. I had faith that these guys wouldn't let anything happen to me. But they weren't beyond giving me a hard time either. And I can't remember which one of them said, "What, is a wampus cat going to get you or something?" And before anything else could happen, my lights hit the boat, and these, I think it was feral cats, they were all over the boat, licking up fish guts and things like that that we had probably left there. And things started happening. They started jumping. And if you've ever seen old men climbing up the banks of Lake Washita, these guys, all you could see was elbows and heels running up that bank. These guys were scared. And they took off. This was fear in these old men. And I thought, this is great. I was scared too. But fear motivates us. And it motivated them. And as I look through the New Testament and all through the Bible, there's many examples of fear, and it motivates us. But the stories about fear got my attention, because we've lived through some trying times here recently, some fearful times, and we've got more times to go, and we're facing a new year when it may be fearful also. A passage that mentions fear. Now, your translation might say, instead of cowardly, it might say fear. And this is a passage I've known before, too. And you probably, I know you've read it. But it says, but as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. This is a list of really bad sins. I'm not a murderer. I'm not a sexually immoral, sorcerer, idolater. And of course, you know, idolater is not always the guy that worships the idol. We don't have any idols around here. But you know, the New Testament talks about it. We worship money and things like that. That's the same as being an idolater. Liars, your portion is in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur. But did you notice the first sin he mentions? These are bad sins. The first sin is fear. The first one. He lumps that in with some really bad sins. And I've marveled at that. These last couple years have been very fearful times. In just a couple of years, we've went from the best economy in the history of the world, really, to the worst history, or the worst economy in American history. Unemployment has skyrocketed the last couple years, and it was all the result of this worldwide pandemic. The virus was released in kind of a scary type way, and I'm not sure we'll ever know how it really got released. And I looked on Google to see how many deaths there's been because of this pandemic, and it's changing so fast you can't really get a good estimate of how many deaths there are. But we could tell there's been over 5 million deaths. 5 million. 1 million's a lot. Used to as a kid, I didn't have a concept of what a million was, but some of you may now have a concept. 100,000 a bunch of times. That's a million. But there's been over 5 million. That's a lot. In excess of over 100,000 small businesses have been closed that will probably never reopen. For the first time in history, a vaccine has been released, developed and released, in less than a year. And there's a lot of fear still out there. There's always being talked about some new strain of this vaccine. I find it interesting that years ago, and I like history, ancient map makers, I think they were called cartographers, they used to print their fears on a map. And in their travels, they would draw the maps. And when they reached the limit of where they had traveled to, you know what they would do with the maps? They would put, beyond this, there be dragons. And I don't know. I just find that so interesting. Beyond this, there be dragons. And beyond this year, folks, there be dragons. There be dragons. Christopher Columbus, when he was raising money for his voyage, he had a hard time getting money for boats. He had a hard time getting money for, or getting crew to be willing to go with him, because they thought they'd fall off the edge of the earth. And I've got to laugh. There are people out there, and I'm not sure if they're serious or not, they still talk about this flat earth thing. And I just want to say, really? You believe the earth is still flat? But the thing is, Christopher Columbus's crew, his men were about to mutiny on him when they actually found land. He was in trouble in those days. And the New Testament, it talks about Satan using fear as an antidote to keep us from doing things that we need to be doing. And I went through the New Testament and just looked at places where fear was a motivating factor to do and not to do certain things. Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy 1:7, and I love this passage. He said, "For God gave us a spirit, not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." And when Jesus ascended back to heaven, he left us with a command not to fear. In other words, he didn't just say, "It's normal to fear." He said, "Don't fear." That's a command. He didn't ask us not to. He commanded us not to fear. John 14:27, and I forgot to hit that and put it up on the board. "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid." Wow, those are reassuring words. There are things that are real reasons to be afraid, but we need to drive the fear out. In Acts 8:3-4, Saul was ravaging the church and entering house after house. He dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. Now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. I can just imagine how much fear this put in the hearts of Christians in those days. Can you imagine somebody storming your house, dragging you off, looking for evidence that you're a Christian, finding Bibles, Christian literature, and realizing you are a Christian, and you having to leave with the clothes on your back and leave the city? Leave Greenwood, leave Dayton, leave Fort Smith, leave wherever you live with just what's on your back and flee the city. That's what happened to those Christians of the first century. And then this guy is converted, and I understand the Christians' reluctance to let this guy come into their assembly. You've ran out of Greenwood because of this guy trying to kill people. Maybe he killed friends of yours. And then he comes into the assembly and says, "Now I'm converted." We want to take him under our wing, do we? I think we're pretty careful about that, aren't we? We've had to flee the city. We've had to leave all of our material possessions in our house and flee the city because of this guy. And now he says he's our brother. My goodness. That's the equivalent of what was happening with these people. But as these brethren fled, notice it said they were preaching Jesus. That's one of the things they took with them, is their faith. When the prophet Elijah fled from Jezebel, he was smart because she was going to kill him. 1 Kings 19:14, Elijah said, "I've been very jealous, probably the word zealous would be more correct here, for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I only am left, and they seek my life to take away." Elijah fled after defeating these prophets of Baal, but he was later told that 7,000 had not given in to Baal. But the thing is, he was wise to flee, but he didn't give up. Jesus told us, as he departed earth, that he would always be with us. He would never forsake us in the Great Commission. I keep forgetting to advance our scriptures up there. But notice he said that he would always be with us. Always. I think that is so important. God promises that he will never stop, regardless of our fear. Hebrews 13. He says, "Keep your life free from the love of money and be content with what you have. For you said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we can confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear." I will not fear. It's easy to say that. Hard to do sometimes. But you know, every one of these promises is dependent upon our obedience. In Numbers 13, the Israelites were promised the land. But did God just say, okay, just march in there and sit down and it's yours? Did that happen that way? I'm sorry, it didn't. Numbers 13, Caleb quieted the people before Moses and he said, let's go up and occupy it. You remember some of the spies said, yeah, we can do it. Others said, no, there's giants in the land. We can't do it. It came down to their faith. They had to occupy their land. God gives us promises, but it doesn't mean we accept those promises while we sit and drink under the shade and drink tea and lemonade. We've got to be faithful to those promises and accept them in such a way as to accept them. John chapter 14, Jesus talks about he has prepared a place in heaven for us, for his faithful followers. He said, I go and prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. But the precondition for the promise is given in verse 1. If you back up, what does it say? Don't let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. That's the first prerequisite. You've got to believe in God. If you don't believe in God, how can you not be troubled? You're going to be troubled without belief in God. Then he says, believe also in me. You've got to believe in God. You've got to believe in Jesus. And then do not be troubled. Matthew 6. Jesus said you've got to seek first the kingdom. You've got to seek His kingdom and His righteousness, and those things will be added to you. The promise is in response to a commitment to serve God with all your strength, to be undivided, to be of one purpose. It involves a level of trust. One must commit ourself before receiving. Jesus promises to be with us and assist us, but that doesn't mean He does everything for us. You know, we get the idea sometimes that the battle is His and we just sit back and take it easy and He takes care of everything. It's not the case. To accept a promise, there's conditions that have to be met. And so many people, it is a free gift, but there's conditions. It's conditional upon accepting those promises and doing what He says. The prerequisite to accepting it. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. He says, put to death. How do you put to death? You drive it away. You drive it away from your mind. You drive it away from your actions. You drive it away from the way that you live. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. There's that word again that we talked about before, covetousness, which is idolatry. We don't worship statues, but he says that covetousness is a form of idolatry. That's New Testament idolatry, worshiping things. And you know, a lot of times we talk about certain things. You know, some of us drive a nice car, or things that money buys. We're guilty of not the money, but what it buys. And some would say, I don't worship money. I've got a situation where it goes through my hands pretty quick. And so we get caught up in all these things. It's easy to do. I remember years ago, a preacher that held a lot of meetings, Jack Exum, he talked about what materialism was. He said he had to keep changing his lesson. He said materialism in his lessons many years ago was somebody that had a two-car garage and two cars. Well, as time went on, it was somebody that had two-car garage, two cars, and a boat. Well, he kept having to change it. So I don't know what they have to... He's not alive anymore, but if he were alive now, I don't know what he would say. Maybe he would add a Harley Davidson or something like that, but I don't know what he would say. But he was a great guy, and he was a great preacher. And he was quite funny when he kept adding to his lesson what worldliness and materialism. But you know, I look back over the years, and from where we came from to where we are now, we are wealthy beyond all means. And I look at some of the other countries and the way they have to live compared to the way we live. We are wealthy beyond all imagination, beyond all generations of times past. As we look at some of these different passages, one passage is when I look at any Bible is Ecclesiastes 5:10. That's a passage that I am quite familiar with. I can't remember if I put it up here or not. I didn't. Ecclesiastes 5:10. Whoever loves money will never have enough money. Now that's from a Common Speech translation. Is that just a confusing type thought? If you love money, you're never going to have enough. You want to have enough money? The antithesis of that? Don't worship it. You want to have enough money? Don't worship money. Think about that. If you want to have enough money, but I don't have much money, you want that to be enough? Then don't worship money. Don't worship it. And you'll have enough. Think about that. 1 John chapter 2. God knows when we get too wrapped up in this world, it's going to choke out other things. It's going to choke out love for Him. It's going to choke out Christianity. It's going to choke out our faith. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that's in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of life, is not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. You ever look at people when they get close to death? What are they interested in? They interested in a new car? No. Are they interested in travel? No. Are they interested in fancy clothes? No. They're interested in going to see the president or some important person? No. They want people around them who love them. And what do? Sometimes they call for the preacher. They call for somebody they think is close to God. Why? Because they realize that's where they're going to be soon. They call for things that they think are important. Why didn't that happen in their life? They were busy chasing money, chasing a job, chasing things that were of the world. Why all of a sudden do their values change? Because they're close to death. And now they're thinking about different things. Why did it take death for them to change their values? Because they realize that they're going to be speaking to the Lord very soon. And they're going to have to give an account. And some say, you know, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in any of that. But in the back of their mind, they're still thinking, there's got to be more than what we see here. And I think there may be. So they end up wanting to talk to somebody of a spiritual nature. And they realize that their life of putting spiritual things aside now was a bad decision. A bad decision. The message in toward the end of Matthew, Matthew 6:24, Jesus said, "No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Some translations say mammon. English Standard Version, which I like and use quite a bit, says God and money. You can't serve two masters. And you may think, well, I've got to work for a living, so I serve a master. Well, you serve an employer. You serve God, is what you're supposed to be doing. Where does your heart lie? What do you follow? Where are you at? Where are you at in your life? Where's your heart at? What are you relying on? Paul, in writing to Timothy, said, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take nothing out of the world. But if we have food and clothing with these, we will be content. You know, when you think about that, we come into the world and we don't have nothing. Oh, we may have parents. You know, everybody has parents. But it don't matter if our parents are rich or poor. We don't have any material possessions. I remember one time my brother asked my dad, when I grow up, where are you going to live? And he says, well, I guess I'll live here. And he said, well, this is my house. And my dad said, no, this is my house. We let you live here. And he couldn't seem to grasp that concept. And he was quite young at the time. I don't remember. He was like 5 years old or something like that. And he couldn't understand the fact that he was going to move on one of these days and he wasn't going to live there forever. And that was not his house, because that was home to him. And my dad, through the years, told that story over and over again, and it kind of embarrassed my brother. But I thought it was hilarious, because he thought that was his house. Where are you going to live? Because he felt like, no, you have to move on. The thing is, we don't have anything when we're born into this world. We're born without anything. And when we die, what do we have? You may have a lot of this earthly possessions, but you know what? You leave them behind. I heard a story one time about a guy that made a lot of money. And he decided he didn't trust much, so he would, every week when he got paid, he would take his paycheck, and he would take quite a bit of it in cash, and he hid it in a safe at his house. Well, when he got near death, he took that cash and he told his wife, I want to take it with me. I want you to take that money and put it in my casket. I want to take my money with me. And she said, it ain't going to do you a bit of good. But he was just determined he was going to take that cash with him. She said, well, you've been a good husband. You've been a good provider. I want to honor your last wishes, so I'll do it. So when he passed on, she took that cash to the bank and wrote him a check and put that check in the casket. So he tried to take it with him. But you know what? You just can't do it. You know, we face an uncertain future. We're going to be where there'd be dragons. But we need to let the Lord walk with us. We need to make Him a priority. Some of us will face imposingly negative events, and others of us, as we look at them, they're going to live a charmed existence. We just don't know what's in store. Psalm 23 tells us, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear. I will not fear. Because it's going to be good. It's going to be good. the Lord's going to be with us. And, you know, even though we face dragons, He will be with us. We're getting ready to sing an invitation song. This was not an evangelistic type lesson. But that's something that has been on my mind for quite some time, is the fact that our fear, it's natural to have fear, but our fear is not founded in Christianity. It's natural to fear, but we need to make the Lord our priority and remember He's going to walk with us every step of the way, and He makes great promises to us. Let's rest assured and enjoy His promises, and no matter what we face, even though we face dragons, He will help us slay them. If you need to respond to the invitation by being immersed in Christ, we provide you that opportunity. Or if you need the prayers of the congregation, we provide you that opportunity while we stand and sing.